Hello, everybody. Welcome to another program of Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here this week with Russ Chianelli as a co-host, and we're going to be talking about materials for photovoltaics and things of that nature, semiconductors. And so what we're going to be doing is talking to Professor Alejandro Briseño from the University of Massachusetts, up there in Amherst, Massachusetts. Welcome to Science Studio, Alejandro.
Well, thank you for hosting me. Great pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's a great pleasure to have you here. And before we get into semiconductors, organic semiconductors versus inorganic semiconductors, let's learn a little bit about Alejandro. How did you get into science? Where did you grow up? All the background things that most people would never think about for scientists. They think we all come out of eggs already formed.
I also thought the same thing. I'm originally from Los Angeles, California. My parents came from Monterrey, Mexico. And this is back in 1966. My father was a butcher. He came to Los Angeles, California, 1966, and he told my mom, you know, give me some time, let me situate myself, get settled, and then you can come with the kids. I wasn't born yet. So about a year later, my mom came here. You know, at the time, my two older brothers were already born. When she arrived here, she just started having children. So my father was a butcher. That's all he knew how to do.
He knew how to be creative also.
What I was going to say is, weren't there any food trucks around in those days? Because they all started there.
Yeah, and there was. And that's how he likely fed himself. But there's a chain of grocery stores in California, at least I know for sure in California, by the name of Vons. And he was one of the butchers there. And his nickname was 20 vacas, means 20 cows, because he was able to butcher 20 cows in a single day. And that was pretty remarkable. I was born in 71. I was the youngest of five children. And we all did well in school. I think I did probably the best. But we were very mischievous as kids. We were always in trouble. You know, this is Baldwin Park, California. This is the 1970s, 1980s. I grew up in a very tough neighborhood. I remember as a child waking up and going to school and having to go back inside, you know, to tell my mom to call the ambulance or somebody overdosed, you know, in our front yard.
Oh, wonderful.
And this is the era of, you know, the epidemic era of the cocaine wars and heroin. PCP, all these nasty drugs that would plague these small cities. So I grew up around a lot of violence. There was a lot of gangs. And luckily, my mom kept us in a straight line.
How did she do that? I mean, this has got nothing to do with science per se, but it's social science. I mean, you read about this. You know that there are certain family structures that somehow seem to keep their children out of all the trouble that's going all around them. I mean, what was that secret that your mother had?
Yep, and that's a great question, and I attribute the success to the Briseño family, well, not only to my father. So first, my father played an important role because he demonstrated what it was like to work hard and be dedicated and responsible. So my mom's responsibility was to raise the children. She ruled with an iron fist. You know, she taught us to be honest. And so who we feared more than anybody growing up as children were my mother.
So it's a pretty interesting childhood, and it taught you to respect a sort of a form of authority that you – but how did that translate into being a scientist as opposed to a warrant officer in the police or something like that?
So that's also a great question. How did I become so engaged in science and so creative? You know, bear in mind, my father was a butcher. He made very little money. Five children growing up in Los Angeles, California. We were poor. We had to make our own toys, you know, spare parts. And, you know, my brothers, everybody was older than me. I was the kid. So I was always observing and I was always playing with scraps. My oldest brother, who's 9 years older than me, he joined the military and left early. But I remember helping him out around the house. He was always building things, breaking things, repairing cars. And so it allowed me to grow up with confidence and I was able to solve problems pretty quickly because I was taught to take advantage of my immediate resources.
So, I mean, you're solving problems both by thinking, but having some form of manual dexterity.
That's right.
You could use your hands.
Of course. And you would never think that this is something important that could help structure you as a scientist. But this is what happened as a kid.
Yeah.
I had to repair things around the house. I had to build toys. I was a real big dreamer.
You know, it's absolutely true because I always tell a story that my thing was my grandfather had a workbench down in the cellar and I could use it when I was a kid. And boy, all the stuff we used to do. You got to just be able to play around.
So where did you go to school? Where did you really understand that science was the game?
Well, I have to take a step back and tell you how I went to school and why it took so long for me to get started. You know, it was 1989. I remember we got somebody knocked on our door, and it was a detective. And he had informed us that my father was murdered. Okay. Yeah, my father was shot 6 times in the head, literally down the street from our home. Everyone had moved out, and this is November 5th of 1989. I had just started my first semester in college, and it was a very difficult time for me. And to this day, you know, the murder is unsolved. And I took the responsibility of supporting my mother and staying home. I had to drop out of college. I worked 4 jobs. And at the same time, I was saving a little bit of money. But it was a very difficult time for, you know, a 17-year-old kid. And I dabbled a lot into alcohol and other prescription medications. So it was a very difficult time for me. And so it took 5 years before I re-enrolled into school again. And, you know, I guess I instituted myself into a rehabilitation center because I wanted a fresh start. And it took 6 months. You know, I stood at home. I was so terrified to go out into the real world. And my mother embraced me and took care of me. And finally, I got up and I said, enough. I'm going to Cal State Los Angeles, and I am going to educate myself. And it was so difficult. My first degree was in biology, and I graduated with a 2.8 GPA. But I was the best chemist in my major. I was getting straight A's. I understood the organic mechanisms. It was just the funnest thing in the world. And I always did really well in the laboratories. And finally, it got to a point where I said, you know, my career, I know what I want to do. I want to be a laboratory technician because I'm really good at building and understanding things.
Actually, that's very perceptive because so much of what we think of as creativity by faculty and students is predicated upon having good technical staff that keep the instrumentation running, create new instruments. And I think it's an area which we don't give enough credit for. It's only when you don't have them you realize my progress is being stymied.
One of the smartest students that I had in my group didn't even know how to use a screwdriver. So just to mention that, how important it is to be technically inclined.
That's right.
But to go back, you know, I thought I was going to graduate and go off and work at a laboratory for the rest of my life, which I was very content with. Remember, I come from a Mexican background family. So long as you keep a stable job, you have a family, hey, you're successful. But I always felt like I was worth more than that. And then a professor at Cal State Los Angeles by the name of Carlos Gutierrez noticed that I had a gift. And he told me, Alejandro, would you like to do a master's degree here at Cal State Los Angeles in chemistry? And me? Yes, you. And I don't have the money for that. Thank you very much, but I don't think I could afford that. And he told me, if I was to support you through a fellowship, would you consider this? And I said, you mean like pay for my education? And he said, absolutely. And I said, yes. And the rest was history. It was so amazing. I did research actually the last year and a half of my undergraduate work. And then I did a year and a half master's. A total of about 3 years.
And what was it on? I was
an electrochemist.
Ah, okay.
I was doing electrochemistry. And I was doing at the time that I didn't realize it, but it was material science.
Mm-hmm.
I was working with conducting polymers. I was doing nano patterning. I was looking at the redox activity of metalloproteins. I honestly thought that I was
This was with Carlos.
This was not with Carlos. This was with a professor by the name of Feiming Zhou, a Chinese professor.
Right.
And he ruled with an iron fist, I'll tell you.
They do.
But Carlos Gutierrez was the main PI of the grants.
I mean, he's been recognized as one of the great mentors in the area of science.
He's been acknowledged by the White House because of this.
Oh, I know. He's a lot of fun, too. Well, look, we spent a lot of time on your background because it's absolutely crucial. And one of the rationales of the program is that people listening, they'll learn a little bit about science, but they'll realize scientists come from all sorts of avenues, right? They don't get created in eggs per se. It's a mentoring and nurturing process. So let's talk a little bit. You talked about your electrochemistry as an undergraduate, and you need conducting materials. Most people, I think, know what are conducting materials. Since we're going to be talking about them, what's a semiconductor? Let's lead into your research by a quick definition of semiconductors.
Sure. So today I'm a professor, an associate professor with tenure at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst in the Polymer Science and Engineering program. It's the top program of the United States, probably worldwide. You know, we're well recognized for what we do. And I am a synthetic chemist. I consider myself a materials chemist. And we synthesize molecules unit by unit that have a conjugated core. That means that these are electronic materials that we call semiconductors. Now bear in mind that a semiconductor, in a traditional sense, is different from an organic semiconductor. In fact, an organic semiconductor is just a plastic. It's not conducting.
Yeah, but tell the audience, why semiconductor?
So,
because sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't.
Yes. So a semiconductor is a material that at room temperature is essentially an insulator, but it requires an external stimuli for it to start producing electricity. And there's essentially three ways of doing this. If you have a plastic that has the ability to conduct electricity, you can do that. You can induce those what are called carriers or electrons by light. Okay, so if you hit this material with light, it'll generate electricity. A classical example of that is a solar cell. The second way of making a semiconductor work is by applying a voltage to it. This is, for example, a transistor. And finally, you can chemically dope these materials, and doping means that you can introduce an impurity. Okay, so if you introduce an impurity, it actually triggers the material to conduct electricity. And this is what we do in the group. We synthesize semiconductors that are used in electronic devices.
And the whole concept of impurity is the fact that when you make materials, sometimes you get impurities in by accident, and that changes their properties. All right,
that's correct.
It's a problem for people who don't want impurities.
Very much so.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, here with Russ Chinelli, and our guest today is Alejandro Briseño from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. And he's been talking about rather a remarkable background that got him into science. And when we come back, we'll be pursuing now his research in organic, that is non-inorganic, semiconductors. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chinelli, Alejandro Briseño from the University of Massachusetts, a material scientist and somebody that's interested in organic semiconductors. So, Alejandro, distinguish, as you were about to do before we went on a break, inorganic semiconductors, organic. What's the big difference?
Many big differences. I would say that the first difference is if you look at an inorganic system and if you look at a crystal structure, atoms are held together by chemical bonds in a unit cell for inorganic systems. For organic semiconductors, they're not atoms. They're molecules. And these molecules are soft. They're flexible. They're processable. You can fabricate devices.
And they tend not to be charged.
And they're not charged.
No.
You know,
so there's no long-range ordering necessarily from charge, but from other rationales.
Well, actually, there is long-range ordering if
from,
it's in a crystal.
Yeah.
It's in a crystal. But the charge delocalization is completely different from inorganic systems. But what's remarkable is, so the advantages of organic semiconductors compared to traditional is that they're processable, they're cheap, they're flexible, and you can fabricate devices on benchtops.
Whereas, what about conductors? Give us an example of an organic conductor.
So a classical example of an organic conductor is polyaniline. Polyaniline is a traditional polymer conductor, and it's doped with a little bit of acid. So here the impurity is, for example, hydrochloric acid. You add a little bit of acid, and it has a counter ion that produces electricity. And these are the kind of materials that we synthesize in my group. And we utilize these conductors for electrodes. We can 3D print them, produce these roll-to-roll. Just like you manufacture newspapers, we do the same thing with these, what we call electronic inks. And so imagine a solar cell that you can print out in a matter of a few hours. You could do this roll-to-roll, these really long sheets. You can section them off and immediately fabricate devices that you can put onto backpacks. You could imagine that these devices would be on the helmets of a soldier, on the rooftop of your car.
Don't they have shirts like that right now where they light up?
And they do, and those are called organic light-emitting diodes.
Yeah.
It's also something that we do in my research group.
What about organic superconductors? I remember back of, I don't know, 20 years ago, I think it was Allied was claiming that they had an organic superconductor.
That's correct. So organic superconductors is an area that also exists, and it was really hot, you know, maybe in the 90s.
Yeah.
And the funding for things like that have sort of tapered off and decreased. And the only reason because of that, in my opinion, is because organic semiconductors found a new niche. You know, bear in mind that the estimated market for organic electronics by the year 2030, it's a $300 billion market industry. But, you know,
is it today?
It's much lower than that.
Oh, yeah, but I mean, has it reached a billion?
I think it has. Okay. Yes, it has. All but right. It's the exponential growth of this in the next years to come is remarkable.
All right.
But, you know, the way we look at this, in order to meet that demand, you've got to make stable materials.
Well, that's the issue, I suppose, is the important one. Because organic molecules, some of them persist in the air and in water, right, but a lot of them don't. And so that's a key area that you're looking at, is to make sure that the substrate organic molecule is stable under an awful large variety, photochemistry, moisture, oxygen.
Correct.
You know, all the things that really foul up a lot of organic systems.
And I'll tell you, I'll give you a classical example of one of the problems with making stable materials. Suppose you get a pair of jeans, you put them on the rooftop of your home, and you come back and you look at those jeans maybe a month later. They will be bleached.
Mm-hmm.
Your jeans will no longer be blue. And the reason is very simple. The environment provides the perfect reagents for chemical modification.
Right.
You have oxygen and light. So if you have light and oxygen, it's like the perfect reagent for chemical synthesis.
Yeah.
Except this is in the solid state. So imagine these dyes that are in your jeans or T-shirts. They're molecules. Now, these molecules, if you provide a little bit of oxygen and light, it's enough to have a chemical reaction where your molecules chemically modified. And it's very simple chemistry known as, for example, cycloaddition chemistry. All of this is thermodynamically favorable, meaning that it really wants to react. So what we do in my group, we synthesize molecules that don't want to react with oxygen or light.
Give us an example, if you can, of a new molecule or a new material that you've created.
So I'll give you an example. There's a compound that's commercially available that's considered to be the benchmark material, but it has its drawbacks, and that compound is known as pentacene. Pent meaning five. Pentacene meaning that it's basically five fused rings that are linear.
Six-membered rings.
Six-membered right. Benzene rings that right. are fused together to form a pentamer.
Is it linear?
It's linear.
This is not the branch variety.
Correct. Okay. It's linear. And it works very well until it sees light and oxygen. And so it decomposes and it bleaches and it no longer works. What we discovered is we synthesized what's known as a dimer of this compound. So now imagine instead of it being linear, you just get another set of molecules and put it directly underneath it. Okay. So now it's called, for example, bispentacene. And instead of five rings, it has 10. But they're no longer linear. They're staggered. And so they have this angular system to it. And by doing this, by changing the chemical composition and the way the molecules are arranged in a compound, this enables us to produce these very chemically stable materials because oxygen
doesn't... So can you make a Gretzel cell that's stable in light now?
In principle, we could, but we focus on not Gretzel cells, but organic solar cells. Yes, exactly. And they're very chemically stable. In addition to that, this material has significantly higher conductivity compared to the benchmark material that I spoke about, which is pentacene.
Let's just go back, though. Pentacene is a linear arrangement of six of these benzene rings.
Right.
The bispentacene, you've just got two groups staggered one on top of the other.
Yes.
Now, was that a known material before you started to investigate it? And did you have prior knowledge from other people that this would be much more thermodynamically and kinetically stable in an oxygen-moist environment?
It's a great question. And the answer is yes. So we were highly motivated and inspired by research that was developed, you know, probably 1940s, 1950s, by a scientist named Klar. And Klar had this idea of what he described as a Klar sextet. And a Klar sextet is basically a benzenoid ring. And he had predicted all of these things in the 1950s, and he drew out all these structures. But it was a very qualitative explanation that he had.
Did he make them?
He made them, right. But he didn't have solid characterization at the time. But in hindsight, when you go back and look at his results, they were right on target, but no proof that he made these.
Ah.
But he did have the chemical structures in his book. So what we did is, you know, we ripped the page out of history and decided to synthesize some of these and some of the compounds that he didn't even point out. And indeed, they were very chemically stable and they work phenomenally well.
Okay. So, I mean, there's this expression that people use about, the current generation making advances on the shoulders of the giants that have gone before them. So, I mean, there's creativity in you deciding to look for substitutes, but then there's the work of Klar that says, hey, you know, these people back in the 50s, they made these interesting molecules, but they didn't have the technology available that we do today to do the detailed analysis and take it one step further. So it's a process of using prior knowledge and taking it one step further. Would you agree to that?
Of course. You're smart if you do that.
Yeah, exactly.
You're smart if you do that. Sometimes it's not worth to reinvent the wheel.
Right. Absolutely.
And that's what we do. And we, you know, we throw in our creativity aspect to this, and we make these compounds more soluble so we could add functional groups to these compounds. And they work very well. They work very
well. What are the impurities that you add? You were saying that, you know, you're into this sort of composite material. What are the dopants, if you like?
Yes. So the way we can chemically dope these is first what we would do is we would grow a crystalline film. It could be an ultra-thin film that you can put on plastics, or it could be a bulk crystal, okay? And these crystals, you know, could be anywhere from several hundred nanometers. To give an audience a sense of what this means is imagine the cross-section of a human hair, 1,000 times the diameter of that. Smaller. So we're talking about nanocrystals, and each of these little nanocrystals can serve as a device. So it ranges from very, very small nanoscale crystals to bulk crystals about the length of your fingernail, about the size of your fingernail. So we can post-dope these with trichlorosilanes.
Ah.
But they have to be perfluorinated, so they have a very strong dipole moment. In the opposite direction. So imagine your table being a crystal and you have these trichlorosilanes that you could deposit from vapor and they have a very strong dipole moment going upwards. And what this does is it sucks the electron density at that interface and produces positive charges because it's taking all of these charges out. And so this induces carriers at the interface.
Yeah, but chlorosilanes are extremely reactive to moisture and things like
and
that.
And that is exactly
so
correct.
So how do you get around that issue?
We depend on that issue, matter of fact. If you think about the surface facet of a crystal, there's monomolecular steps, and there are a little bit of morphological defects. And if you think about the classical theory of nucleation, these step edges are high in surface energy. And so they're perfect places for something to nucleate on. And there's also moisture at these interfaces. Water molecules are essentially impossible to remove. So when this trichlorosilane comes and hits the surface of these steps, essentially they polymerize and cross-link and you have...
So you get this silicon-oxygen coating on top of your active
correct
film.
Yes, right. And your product is basically Cl and H, so a little bit of acid is produced in such minimal quantities that it doesn't dope anything. And that's one of the mechanisms that we use for doping.
And what's the particular utilization that you foresee for this type of material? Is this like on the helmets or on the top of motor car roofs so that you can keep charging up the battery? Or tell us what the potential is.
So for this particular example, we can dope these ultra-thin single crystals with these trichlorosilanes, and it goes from a semiconductor to a conductor. And we can put these crystals on very thin plastics, almost skin-like. And you could make these skin-like sensors that are called strain gauges.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So it's very sensitive to any movement.
Wasn't there one that was Silly Putty and something else where the spider can walk on it and you can tell where the spider goes?
That's correct. And so this is an example of something that was just published in Science where somebody used Silly Putty and they mixed it with graphene.
Yeah.
And this was now a very conducting elastomer, like a rubber type of material. And because it's conducting, any small movements and any change in strain.
The article says that they can track a spider walking across it, and then it says, however, a spider does what it wants. It doesn't go where you want it to.
That's true.
Well, we often have the same problem. We'd like to go somewhere, but we can't because we run out of time. So Alejandro Briseño, University of Massachusetts Amherst, material scientist, semiconductor. Well done. Congratulations.
Thank you very much, Keith.
Yes, and congratulations to you for a very interesting. We'd love to have you back and talk more about it. But I would like to know, are you going to commercialize this?
The PGA is very interested in our crystals because we produce nanograss. We can produce these very small little crystals that stand vertically just like grass. And so they're interested in producing a center where we produce artificial grass for golf.
And we'd like to thank Lauren Terrazas for putting this program together so it sounds beautiful for you out there. And, of course, we thank you out there for listening. We'll be back next week. Take care. Bye-bye.